Well, welcome to the podcast, Jans.
Okay. Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And for those who don't know who you are, you've been around for a long time and done so many interesting things. I'm wondering if you could give us just a thumbnail sketch of your background and how you ended up where you are.
Well, I'm a, for the purposes of this interview, I'm a cognitive scientist. I've always been interested in how people think and how to model human thinking. And in the process of doing that, I fairly early got into representing knowledge in the form of graphs, right? And so my thesis was actually about modeling car driver behavior with a rule-based system, more than 2,000 rules that could really well kind of simulate how a human drives in traffic. And this is 30 years ago, so it was in a simulated traffic environment. Anyway, so yeah, interested in graphs for a very long time. About 20 years ago, I came from the Netherlands to California to run a company called France Inc., the company where I still work, right? It was originally a Lisp compiler company because I always had been using the Lisp compiler to do my AI work. And then, so when I got here, the company needed a new direction, and the direction we chose was to do graph databases. And well, for the last, I would say, 15 years, I've been helping companies build graph applications. Is that about something you were looking for?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting what you've done in previous lives and how you got to where you are. Tell us a bit about the database business and why you chose graphs over some other type of database, and it's a particular kind of graph. You're on Allegro Graph 8.0, correct?
Yes, yes. Well, I before I came here, I worked for the Dutch Telecom, and I was doing applications in very large in-memory databases. So I was kind of interested in that. And then combine that with my interest in graphs. Yeah, graph databases seem to be kind of a natural extension of the things I was interested in. I was also a Prolog programmer. So I was also always interested in how can I run big logic programs, right, on real data, right? And again, a graph database is the perfect medium for if you want to write Prolog programs, right? And Prolog programs on simple databases is not fun. It's kind of boring. You want to have very complex data in your databases to kind of create interesting applications.
So it seems like it lends itself to complex business problems and modeling real world scenarios.
Yeah. So I worked for many, many different companies in healthcare, finance, publishing, pharmaceutical, even some legal stuff, government stuff. And people always ask me, so how do you do this, all these different topics? And I said, well, when I get into a new situation, all I do is I try to find how I can take the problem that they have, turn it into a graph problem, and then I'm at home and I can solve the problem, right? So it's almost like in math, right? As long as you can reduce it to a known problem, then you're off to the races. And so this is how I've been in many different types of business, but yeah, I found that almost always business problems can be transformed or translated into graph problems. And then my type of knowledge graph approach works.
And so recently, you and I have talked about entity event approaches, as well as new kinds of identity management. And so you've tackled those. Those are thorny problems in and of themselves, and just sort of spells out that the wealth of different problems that you could solve using your approach.
Early on, I saw that almost all business problems that we were tackling had a very strong temporal component, and sometimes also a spatial component, and sometimes and almost always like a social network or a graph component, right? So I was already writing about complex event handling, I would think 12, 13 years ago, right? To do that with graph. And then at some point, we worked with a big company in the telecom space. The company name was Amdocs, where they tried to create a CRM system where if you called up your telephone company, right? The person on the other end of the phone trying to solve your problem wouldn't have to get into 11 different databases, but just kind of would have a holistic view of you as a person, right? And a telecom user into an holistic overview. And they tried to do it in many different ways. They were Oracle experts, but it was just too complicated. And finally, they came up with this solution where they said, you know what? Everything that ever happens to a telecom user is an event, right? That happens at some point in time, right? So let's model everything we can find in the databases that we need to solve a customer problem as an event, right? And so we came up with a model that the customer was the core entity, and then, well, all the data from all the different databases they needed were modeled as events attached to that person. And the advantage was that you can look now as a entity, both as a graph and as a series of events, right? If you look at a graph, you can do business rules on the graph. If you look at it as a series of events, you can start doing event prediction, right? And so these people that I work with from MDocs, they kind of came up with this whole entity event approach. And then later I worked with a big hospital in the Bronx where we kind of came up with the same model for patients, right? With the core entity is the patient. And then anything that happens to a patient in any of the encounters, clinics, what have you, was turned into an event object. So think of it like an encounter, right? Whether it's in the hospital, inpatient or outpatient, or in the emergency room or in a small clinic. And within those encounters, you had sub-events like a diagnostic or a test or a medication prescription, right? And all these things can also be modeled as events. And so the same approach we used for telecom also applied in healthcare. And then later we applied it in other domains, for example, for aircraft, for the FAA, or for customers in a call center, right? But always the same approach. You have a core entity, and that core entity has events and sub-events that then always terminate in a knowledge base of terms. And you can always look at the entity as a holistic graph and as a series of events, right? So that is kind of the core of this entity event modeling.
And people might not be familiar, but the term knowledge graph comes up a lot in conversation nowadays. And Gartner has declared the knowledge graph to be in year zero in terms of importance for people who are really trying to do t digital transformation, for example. This is all part of this the knowledge graph phenomenon that's been materializing for over a decade now, or over 2 decades, really.
Yeah, a knowledge graph is more like a, I sometimes call it the application layer on top of the underlying graph database, right? So the graph database is just a knowledge graph that's good at storing network information, complex information. A knowledge graph it refers more to the application that you're building with the graph database technology. And nowadays, every interesting knowledge graph that I know of whether it's in healthcare or in a digital twin or whatever, it always has this component of logic to try to solve part of the problem. It combines machine learning, and recently it also involves generative AI, right? So all the interesting knowledge graphs that I know of that people are recently using always has this kind of conglomerate of AIs, right, attached to a knowledge graph.
Exactly, but there are a lot of people who are working with AI who might not be familiar with the methods that you're using. And
Well, one thing that we came up both in telecom and in healthcare is, so you might have a graph database with, and so you took the complex data that you have in various silos and legacy systems, and you kind of integrated it and put it into a knowledge graph, right? So, and now you do interesting things with it, right? You try to predict the next event, or you try to classify something, or anyway, so you have these things that you do with the data, but the reason to have a knowledge graph is that you can take the output of all the other AIs that you use and put it back in the database, so you can create a learning, well, you create a learning loop, right? So if you're just a data scientist and you have a bunch of, say, data, and you do your analytics, right, that now you have a prediction. But if you don't put the prediction back into your data infrastructure, right, the prediction just hangs in the air. People can do maybe useful things with it, but you haven't created a learning system so that in the next cycle, well, so you can do meta learning, right? Like, what learning mechanism worked really well? What did we learn about this patient? Hey, I can take a set of patients and that have diabetes and put them in 22 different clusters, and some medications only work for people in those clusters, but other people in these clusters. Why is that, right? So you can now do more advanced learning, right? So you kind of build not only on the hard data that you have, but also the inferences that you made about those data.
What I'm taking away is that there are other kinds of learning, but besides the statistical machine learning approaches that are extremely relevant to the problems that we're facing with today's AIs. And so you've obviously examined what's happening with the current iteration of AI. Can you describe your critique of it? I know I've seen it in your slides.
So in our marketing recently, we're talking about our graph database system, graph database platform as a neurosymbolic platform, right? Meaning we have a knowledge graph that can work with regular machine learning, for example, to do event predictions, specifically recurrent neural networks, or event or entity classification using graph neural networks. So that is like the machine learning part. And then we have LLMs, right, that will help with certain things you want to do with the knowledge graph. And then you have logic, whether it's description logic or something more powerful like a Prolog, right? So so when we talk about neurosymbolic AI, we talk about this, call it composite AI, right? Where your knowledge graph uses machine learning, uses generative AI, and uses logic, right? Now, each of these AIs that you use have very strong points and weak points, right? So, for example, if you take a logic, right? If you write logic on top of your knowledge graph, right? Then you, let me say this. So you can be very precise and consistent, right? When you have a logic program, because you write your rules, you know exactly what you do. So it's very transparent to see how your rules work, and you can explain what your rules do. But the problem is with rules is, and I know because I've done that, is that you write a system with 2,000 rules, right? And now I need to add one more case. So I need to add like another 20 rules. But what you find out is that it's in every time when you add a new rule, you also add another opportunity to kind of mesh with the other rules that you already had, right? And so it becomes more and more complicated to add new rules. And if you write a rule-based system, you can never kind of can cover all the cases that you want to cover. So the strength of logic is it's precise, consistent, transparent, but it's really hard to maintain, right? And it's not as flexible as you might want it to be. But if you then look at machine learning, I mean, so I would say the last 15 years, we've been doing logic, right? We did description logics, but we also did Prolog to do. So the issue with description logic is it's really good at classification, but as soon as you have to deal with time and location and series of steps, then description logic don't work anymore. But then you can use a full logic language like Prolog, right, to still get really good results out of your knowledge graph. Anyway, so I talked about the strong and the weak points in logic, right? But now let's look at machine learning, right? So about 10 years ago, we got, but also all the other people in the world of knowledge graphs got deep into machine learning, right? So say you have a series of events for a patient or an aircraft or a customer, right? Now you want to use machine learning to do predictions. And it's kind of amazing, right? That instead of you having to write rules, you just give the series of events to a recurrent neural network, and it will start to learn how to predict events, right? So it's, or we use graph neural networks to classify entities of certain kinds or to predict whether certain links between entities should exist, right? And it kind of all does it automatic. Although, to be honest, right, representing the input events or the input vectors is still a pretty hard problem, right? But again, it still learns rules completely automatic. But the downside is that a lot of businesses don't want to work with machine learning because they can't explain why something happens, right? So usually, machine learning model is like a black box. And although there's more and more software that makes it easy to extract rules out of these machine learning models, but still, it's hard to understand why the model makes certain choices. And then the other thing we know is that machine learning models have bias, right? And you can't blame the machine learning model for the bias, but because basically what you put in, you get out, right? But there's lots of cases where machine learning models are very discriminatory. From people of color, people, females, and poor people, et cetera, right? So, and again, you can't blame the machine learning model. It basically a machine learning model reflects the world, right? But still, if people make decisions, no one complains about it. Well, if a machine learning model has bias, then people instantly start to notice. Anyway, that is about machine learning, and then. For the last 2 years, our world kind of exploded, right? Because we suddenly had OpenAI and the LLM models. And we now can do so many things with generative AI and knowledge graphs, right? I mean, the strong part of it is that I mean, I'm a psychologist. I've always been interested in language. I wrote my own parsers. I did a lot of work with the entity extraction. And I still can't believe, I still wake up every day and I just cannot believe how amazing these generative AI models are, right? So that is the strong point. On the other hand, I never, ever trust any inference that comes out of an LLM, right? Because you never know, it might be hallucinating, it might lead you in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
So you always have to double check, right? And
Yeah,
so now the whole issue with generative, sorry, with neurosymbolic AI is how can the strong points of one AI make the weak points of another AI better, right? I think that's right now the name of the game, right? You've got three classes of AIs that you can do something with, and how can you make sure that by using them together, you get better output, more trustable output?
Exactly. And one of the things you seem to be alluding to is with the learning loop is a data management paradigm that could be extremely useful for data scientists who aren't familiar with graph databases, for example. If it's just seems like there is a much more organic approach to data lifecycle management with a graph, a semantic graph. Is that a good assertion to make?
Well, if you just have a one dumb straight table, right, that you want to do data science on, then it really doesn't matter what you do, right? But if the data that you want to do your data science on is complex in itself with lots of side connections, et cetera, right? Of course, then it makes sense to use a graph as your input, right? And you then extract parts of the graph to feed into your machine learning models. But my point is, it's kind of silly if you just take these predictions, but you don't put the predictions themselves back in the graph database so that you create a feedback loop, right? So now you can check later if it came, if your prediction actually worked well or didn't work, right? But also you can check the results of your machine learning later. So, I work on a patent with the hospital in the Bronx, where we have what we call an analytical tapestry, where we say any analytics you ever do needs to go back in the database, and that and you need to have an ontological approach to your learning, where you say, well, if I do an analytics, then at least we have the name of the analytics, the data sets we used, the algorithms we used, the people doing the research, and what time you did it. Right, but the full provenance and lineage of where the data came from, so that if there's anything wrong in your predictions, you can always go back to your data and figure out what data you even were using, right, to get to that prediction. If you don't store all the metadata around analytic, right, then within a few months you don't know what happened anymore. So it's almost like I think, so in the European Union, right, there's this law that if you get a grant from the European government to do research, that the output of all your data is disseminated in a way and stored in a way with metadata so that later other people can use all the data that you did not use, right? Or test the data that you used, right? And also the results of the data need to be put in databases so that people later can check what actually happened. Does it make sense? It's
It does. It does. And it makes me wonder, okay, why haven't most companies been working this way? It just seems like the provenance and the rework required, if you don't have this method, would be so enormous that you'd just be wasting a lot of time and effort redoing things over and over again. So
So,
it just seems obvious that we would have this kind of
yeah, people are so ingrained with SQL, right? And in row and column thinking, right? Even with the modern cloud Databricks systems and all of that, right? I mean, what kind of editor do you use, and how long have you been using that editor, right?
right. It's
I'm an Emacs user. I've been using it for 40 years. No one is gonna take that away from me, right? It's yeah. I'm a Lisp user. If I have to write complex programs, I use Lisp and Prolog, right? Because that's what I know, and I'm really, really good at, right? And
Yeah.
of course, I can use other languages, but yeah, my first instinct is to use the languages that I know. And I think that's really almost at the heart of it. It's so hard. And then, of course, the entire other thing, and you even have quoted me on this, is that so we have this graph database that is entirely semantics based, right? Based on W3C standards, right? Based on the semantic web technology, where our number one rule is that everything, whether it's a concrete thing or an abstract thing, gets a unique name, right? And I always make the joke that if in a big enterprise, all the every primary key and every foreign key, right, had is standardized or is it say a URI, right? You would have already a semantic web in your in all the databases in your enterprise. But of course, no one does that. They just have dumb auto increment integers in their tables, right? That's about it. But okay, so our graph database is built around this notion of the semantic technology, semantic web, right? The same thing needs to have the same name or identifier. And so when what I've talked about before is that most of our customers are way over 35 to 40, right? Because it's almost always the people that have been successful building new applications and new databases in the companies that they worked for. And at some point, they start to notice that 70% of all the money in IT goes to data integration. But every time you build a new app or a new database, right, you build a new silo, right? You create faster new silos and you can integrate them, right? But people in the semantic technology world, right? Well, let me say it another way. So people in normal in IT, right, when they have to make a new database, new application, they never ever think about, okay, how's my database going to work with every other database in the company? They don't think about it. They also didn't get that job. Their boss didn't tell them, hey, I want you to solve this problem, but please make sure it works also with every other database. When the manager doesn't even know that he has to ask that, right? He wants to solve a problem, right? And he gets a young guy, smart, who grabs any tool he can get, and he quickly builds a new application that solves the problem that his boss wanted to be solved. He probably did a fantastic job. The only downside is from the perspective of the company that you now have a new silo, right? A new thing that doesn't work with anything else. And so that's why we get these people over that have had enough disappointment in their lives that, hey, there has to be a way where we can create new databases, right? Where I can link to all the other data that I have in the company, right? And so, sorry, I didn't do a great job of explaining, but I hope.
No, this is good. This is good. And it leads me to wondering about the hospital in the Bronx that you were talking about. And they've had success with your approach, the approach that you've advocated and built a system around. In many for many different use cases over a course of years, correct? And they've built a system in parallel that sounds like it's competing in some ways with the whole legacy environment. I mean,
Well, we do knowledge graph projects for other customers, right? I've learned not to talk to the new customers about using graph database as a system of record, right? Because then the entire IT department will get a right. But at some point, you have to wait till they say, yeah, but why do I keep all the other databases around? I said, well, that's up to you to decide, right? If you want to continue with the graph database as system of record or not. I mean, we made sure that our graph database is 100% ACID compliant, right? And very, very crash resistant. We run tests all day here at our company where do tests to insert and sorry, well, insert delete queries, right? And at random moments, we just do a kill minus nine for the database, or we take the power out, we start up again. The database always should be going. You should never lose a transaction, right? So you can use a graph database like ours as a 100% system of record. But again, I never lead with that because then people get into a panic.
Well, so the question becomes, Gartner's saying great things about this general approach, and so we've been waiting for this time when that's happened, and AI, you're seeing what I read was something like 5,500 startups that are VC funded, that are AI startups at this point.
Yeah, undoubtedly.
And there are just hundreds of semantics companies that exist, and many of those are underfunded. So how do we shift the balance so that an approach that has all this promise gets more of the funding and more of the attention?
Well, I wish you could tell me, right? I mean, so there's property graph companies, right? That has an enormous amount of funding, right? And in our space, nearly no, actually, all graph databases are now venture funded. We're not, right? We're completely self-funded, but I see a positive trend. I see the graph databases, the semantic graph database companies, getting more and more venture investment. But yeah, what can I say?
Yeah, I think the other question I have is, your whole deck is about neurosymbolic AI, and there are some professors in academia who are behind that approach. Amit Sheth, for example, is one of them. Some of his disciples have also got programs, research programs going at universities. But in general, academia is really just sort of entrenched in the old approaches so much that you can't break them loose from it. And it's hard to get solid programs going at in mainstream academia that sort of help people get up to speed on what you've been talking about.
Well, that's also a tough question. I remember when I was working for the university in the Netherlands, right, and I was writing proposals to do AI, right, that the professors in the committees, right, that giving out the rewards, right, this was all way new for them, right, and so it was not in the mainstream. I also saw it in the funding of the National Science Foundation, where I was in committees, right, where everything that was too new just didn't make it because it was, they didn't know it, right? And so there's an incredible resistance to change, even in academia, which is kind of, you would think that that's where all the change would come from, right? But it's very incremental in academia.
It
It
is.
is usually, so for example, the US government did this OKN, right, this knowledge graph initiative, and then suddenly universities, right, got on it. But before that, I didn't see anything interesting, hardly anything. I mean, a few areas, right, where there's a lot of graph or semantic technologies, but it was slow going. And I can't entirely blame the universities because if you want to do interesting graph applications, you need interesting data, right? And getting data, I mean, data is the new gold, right? The new oil, whatever you want to call it. And everyone is sitting on top of it. So having data sets that you can do something interesting with is really, really hard.
Yeah, we've read about the large language models running out of data to work with, and a lot of that data has been scraped off the public web, and has, it sort of creates a garbage in, garbage out scenario. The internal data, you talked about the data cartels just sitting on it, and so it doesn't get shared and reutilized the way it should.
Yeah, I was sitting in a conference last week where people from the, so for example, you have this Elsevier, right, with lots of scientific magazines, right, with very, very good peer-reviewed papers, right? But if you want to have one of those papers, you have to pay for it. So the pharmaceuticals was talking about that they're already paying Elsevier, right, to get access to all the scientific publications. But Elsevier doesn't want to give their data to the OpenAI models, right? So if you now want to do research as a medical researcher, you need the latest research about certain substances and the effects thereof and whatever, what have you. You can't find it in your LLM, right? Because Elsevier didn't want to give the data. And I understand Elsevier wants to make money, right, with their articles. But it's also hindering progress, right, in the scientific world. Because one of the cool things of LLM is it can read all the PubMed articles, and we can't, right? So and the OpenAI and others are all built on top of PubMed, right, with the 36 million articles, probably 40 by now, right? Plus probably double that for other sources of information about the medical world. But the interesting thing was that the pharmaceutical company said, hey, we're already paying for Elsevier, but we don't get the benefit because Elsevier doesn't want to give it to the LLM. Whereas the New York Times and others, right, and authors are complaining, hey, they stole my books, right? And so it's a really complex issue because on the one hand, you want the information in the LLM. On the other hand, it's super unfair, right? I mean, LLM is basically profiting from all the knowledge and creativity of humanity, right? And selling it back to you.
Maybe we should talk about the problems that a company has that are feasible to solve. And the internal data accessibility problem is one of those. What should companies be doing that they haven't done to free up the data that they're sitting on?
Well, that's a hard question again, because it's competitive data, then they're going to give it away, right?
Well, the default has been for years and years that, let's not give access to anybody unless we've got prior authorization, right? So every time you get access, you have to get the authorization first.
Very, very hard problem. But especially if you look within the enterprise, even within the enterprise, right? This, I mean, I've seen certain banks that say people want to build a knowledge graph and use information from different parts of the business, right? To make a holistic overview of a customer. And they can't get their own data, right? Because data is controlled by the data czar. And his bonus is entirely determined by that no one ever does anything untoward with the data, right? It's just his thing is about data security, right? He's not incentivized. When I give talks, and I run into that all the time. And so, on the one hand, I think you see a rise in simulated companies building simulated data, right? Because you just need to simulate the data for research. But on the other hand, I think that the chief security officer, whatever they might call them, need to be incentivized that half of their bonus comes from innovative use of their data. Right? So if there's not, if nothing innovative is done with that data, right, they miss half the bonus. They need to have the incentive to make the data available for secondary, tertiary use, right?
Exactly.
But if you, but it never happens, right? I mean, I know so many security officers, right, that they don't care, right? But ultimately, it always comes down to a battle, right, at a higher level. How do you call that? Anyway, yeah, you get my point.
So what should folks in the data science and semantics communities, the practitioners, do over the next few years to at least be successful to the extent they can? What's a near-term strategy that would work for these communities? I know they need to work together more, but that's an abstract thing.
Yeah.
It's that there's this organizational transformation that needs to happen, and I think that you've seen success stories over the years. What's the formula for success that the companies the standout companies have used? What's their formula like?
Well, there always needs to be a visionary. I mean, that's my, I 100% believe this. There needs to be a visionary in a company that believes in the graph, right?
Yeah.
If you don't have that visionary, so you're doing a fantastic project and the visionary goes to another company or leaves, right? And then the people that follow up don't have that vision, right? And very quickly it dissolves. So it's still very person dependent,
Yeah.
champion dependent. That's what I see. And we all know in our industry those champions, right?
Yeah, I always think about the foxes and the hedgehogs, and the you're looking for the foxes. The hedgehogs know how to do one big thing and just do it over and over again. The foxes can learn to do different things in different ways. And the curious ones are the ones who tend to be more visionary.
Yeah. But again, I mean, I'm not entirely, I'm actually pretty optimistic because I see all the big I see all the big analyst firms now very firmly talk about the role of knowledge graphs in the IT infrastructure, right? I see lots of articles where people combine knowledge graphs with generative AI. Even the CEO of NVIDIA gave a talk, right? And he talked about the importance of combining LLMs with knowledge graphs so that the knowledge that you create by using the generative AI doesn't kind of disappear, right? But gets stored and checked and where the knowledge graph itself is smart enough to actually interact with the LLMs, right? We need knowledge graphs to turn into agents, right? That can talk to LLMs, right? And in self-introspect and get the data into sequences of event to do sequence prediction, right? So that's where it's going to go. It's going to be agent-based approaches to knowledge graphs. Become way, way more intelligent to organize their own data, shape it in a form so you can do the traditional machine learning, right? And even write their own logic.
Well, and the prompt interface has certainly teed that up, that possibility that we'd have a phase of agent-oriented growth here, because things are finally coming together in that sense.
Yeah, I remember. So I came out of the world of telecom, and so I did a lot of work with speech recognition. And again, I'm stunned at how good speech recognition has become, right? And I was doing work with language, and look at what we now have LLMs, right? And I also did all kinds of projects with agent-based computing. So I'm guessing that's close. nearby. It's real sure we'll have way more agent-based, autonomous agents, right, that can do tasks for us and organize our data in a way more autonomous way.
So what is Franz thinking about over the next 6 months in terms of the kinds of developments that you want to get behind? What's new and different in your pipeline?
Well, we integrated a vector store into Allegro Graph, so into our product, right? So we can now take all the content of our knowledge graph, all the instruction data, and say, hey, create an embedding for that. And now we can literally, and then we created a knowledge graph. Sorry, we created a knowledge graph and LLM generated chatbots. So you can have whole conversations with your own data, right? So having a conversation with your own data, that is the new thing, right? But in an intelligent way where you use anyway, I mean, you've read all about RAG, right? And about vector stores, but it's actually way more complicated to get good results out of a vector store than you might think. And knowledge graphs are absolutely helpful in that respect. For example, say you put thousands of contracts into a vector store, right? Into your knowledge graph and you build embeddings. Problem with contracts is that they're all kind of variations of each other, right? So the lawyers are basically copy machines, right? That change a few names here, a clause here, whatever. But then they're the same. So if you want to use a vector store to ask something about a specific set of contracts, right? You just can't ask the whole set of contracts your question. Now you better do pre-selection, and then even when you get an answer, you check, okay, where did I get my answers from, right? To understand if I really was talking to my own document, how would I was talking to an document that might have higher dot product values or cosine similarity values, but unfortunately was not what you really were looking for. So there's a lot of work going to be done there to do a mix of classical querying and vector store search in the same paradigm. We've developed that. 8.2 will be out in about a few weeks, I would say, right? Where you now can build your own chatbot and talk to your own documents. Super cool. Super cool. But then some other things are right now, we can talk to OpenAI. And we already have all the stuff in-house to talk to all the other Hugging Face models, right, or other available models. But in 8.3, we'll have a full interface to any private LLM that you want, right? So that's another big step forward for us, right? And then, of course, the whole industry is also looking at Sparkle generation, right? Query language generation, right? And that's again an art in itself. All the knowledge graph companies say, oh, we have a solution. And it works really well for the Northwind database. But if you have really complex graphs, then again, query generation is hard, right? But we have some, I've seen examples in the world of SQL databases that are just stunning. And I think we can do the same thing for knowledge graphs, right? Where instead of writing Sparkle queries, you just say what you want and it will come up with the query that it thinks you asked, right? And then do whatever you think it needs to do. So that's the subtraction.
Yeah, I think it's a really promising time, and it sounds like you all are focused on a lot of the right things that need to happen, and it takes time to bring these things to fruition. So thanks for everything you do and have done in the past, and thanks for taking the time today to talk to us about this.
Yeah. Okay. Well, my pleasure.